that's in effect saving somebody money. It's a thing of value that you're giving to some business, but not to others. If you decide that we want to give tax relief to all businesses or all businesses over or under a certain size, that's a general tax policy. I think it's the same thing if government decides that they're going to decrease taxes on all sales taxes or income taxes or something. That's not a subsidy for somebody. A subsidy is where you give it to one party, one person, one business, and not to everybody else in the same situation. And I would argue that government subsidies for private businesses, which are usually defined and usually sold by the recipients and the givers of the subsidy as a, quote, win-win situation. I'm sick of the word win-win in government. Everybody says win-win, and I always figure somebody might be losing. But the politicians who grant the subsidies and the recipients of them call them win-win. I would argue they often take advantage of taxpayers who end up footing the bill. And they are usually, one thing that I would say is in common with almost every corporate subsidy I've seen, is that they're very complex financing deals. They hide behind the complexity of it. They're put together by well-paid lawyers and lobbyists who can put together clever packages. And as an example of how that works, the whole issue of professional sports stadiums, realistically, it's a decision that governments make to put public dollars into this particular sector of the particular type of business. And you can argue for good or for bad, you do that, but the thing is, it is a cash subsidy. It might be smarter for some team owners, it might be more efficient to give a subsidy. I've talked to a number of economists, say, look, if you want to subsidize professional sports, why don't you just write out a check to the team owner? They will decide if they can make more money in a new stadium or not make more money in a new stadium. But there's a simple reason government doesn't, and I would argue that's because it's not complex enough. And if you tried to ask in Seattle how many people think we should write out a big public check to Paul Allen, I think he's about the third richest person in the world now. Should we write out a check to Paul Allen? I think it would go differently than the idea of building a new stadium. Minnesota, the three existing professional sports teams we have in Minnesota are all owned by billionaires. We only have about four billionaires in the state, and one of them is not a Minnesota billionaire. But if you talk about writing out a check of taxpayer money to a billionaire, it's not going to go over anywhere. But you say, we're going to build you a public facility, then it goes a little bit differently. Let me give you a couple of non-sports illustrations of some corporate subsidies and why I have some big concerns about this. About 3 or 4 months ago, and these are both Minnesota examples, 3 or 4 months ago, maybe it was 7 or 8 months ago now, the top development official for the city of Minneapolis, Minneapolis Community Development Agency head, director of that, took a new position with a large developer in the Twin Cities area, vice president of something, and well-paid position. And at the time she took the job, the response of city officials across the board seemed to be, wow, this firm is very lucky. They got a very talented employee. And I don't doubt they got a very talented employee. I think it's unfortunate that very little attention was paid to, somebody wants to play piano and all kinds, that's okay. Very little attention was paid to the fact that this same top development official had just few months prior to that completed negotiations on a taxpayer subsidy for redevelopment downtown Minneapolis, in which the taxpayer subsidy was at least, depending on whose numbers you use, somewhere between $20 and $30 million. And you can question, well, maybe this subsidy was necessary to redevelop the land. There was another developer interested in putting in a development of the same property that was not asking for any corporate subsidy. They were willing to do it without the public subsidy. Another example, the other one I want to give, I don't know what you call it elsewhere in the country. I know it's fairly well known, the Mall of America. Do you call it the Mega Mall? The world's largest indoor mall in Bloomington, Minnesota, was built with a lot of government subsidies. One part of it is still dragging out. This thing's been around for most of the decade now, and it's been very successful, and the investors in it took some risks. Taxpayers put a lot of money into it, so taxpayers put in a lot of risk too. But the developers, they put in some risk, and they got their money back, handfuls for every hand they put into it. But they, as part of the deal, back in 1988, the city of Bloomington offered as one of the incentives to make them build a bigger and bigger thing, because they'd rather start small and if it succeeded put more on, but they wanted to do more at once. So the city threw in a number of incentives. If you build this much, you'll get this, and build this much, you'll get this. One of the incentives they added was to give a 33-acre site just east of the mall. They offered to sell it to them with some tax incentives and so on for $1. The Bloomington mayor was quoted as saying, well, we gave that to them. It was kind of a throw-in part of the deal. And so they had all these other subsidies. They were basically done negotiating, and the guy said, hey, would you throw in this piece of vacant land? It had one farmhouse on it. It was called the Kelly Farm. It was a dilapidated farm building. And so the city put on some, we call tax increment financing, to get rid of the blight. They had to knock down this old barn. Mall owners have said that tax increment financing subsidy is worth maybe $50 million. That's a lot of money to tear down an old barn. But anyhow, fast forward several years. In 1996, the Twin Cities Airport, we've been debating for about a decade what to do with it. Do we expand it where it is, or do we do what Denver and other cities have done and move it to a new location further out? Because airport noise and all the traffic and other problems. Well, in 1996, the legislature, finally, the decade-long study was being completed, and the legislature was going to vote whether we were going to keep it in place and expand it there or move it. Well, the mall owners, which own this property just east of there, lobbied. They joined a group that had hired a lobbyist to keep the airport in place. The airport being close to the mall was great. They had people flying all the way from Japan just to go shopping there. It's true. They have plane loads come in from Tokyo, fly in there, and people go shopping for 2 or 3 days and fly back. It's a different world, but people do it. In any case, the mall had an obvious reason for wanting the airport nearby. It's really good for their business. So they lobbied for that. They did know at the time that putting it there meant we were going to put in a new runway there because it couldn't handle it. That was all part of the plan, same bill even, the Capitol, was to put in a new runway. And runways, both by federal law and state law, have some height restrictions. You can't have runway ends, property ends, and then you put up a skyscraper next to it. The planes have to have a certain amount of altitude clearance. So they were going to restrict the height on this piece of property that the mall owners paid $1 for. And the mall owners, again, they lobbied to keep the airport put and expand it there, knowing there were going to be height restrictions on this property or so, but wanting it anyway because the value to the mall was so much greater. But at the same time they were lobbying at the Capitol to keep it there, they started going to the city of Bloomington and the Airports Commission saying, you know, we're going to sue you guys because we're losing hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's a quote, hundreds of millions of dollars of development right on this property that we invested $1 in. Well, long and short of it is, last month they basically cut a deal in which they traded that property for a 53-acre property north of the mall, which is even, it's closer to the Twin Cities downtown, so it's better piece of property, it's bigger piece of property. The estimate is that it's worth about $10 million more than the one they got. And they passed it because they were afraid that the mall owners would sue. Since the mall owners were claiming that they had an ironclad case that they were going to win hundreds of millions of dollars, you might question why the Airports Commission should believe that they're going to settle for just $10 million out of their generosity. I mean, this is pure greed to lobby for one thing, and then assuming you win it, you're going to sue because you won. But that's the way it works. I'd argue that it's outrageous to do this, but in these corporate subsidies, lawyers and lobbyists are, they're everywhere. Their fingers, the law firm that represents the mall, the lobbyists were all the same firm. One of them was a former member of the Bloomington City Council, I believe, member of our Metropolitan Metropolitan Council, the Planning Council in the past. They've had their hands in every step of the thing for 20 years now, and they're winning fistfuls of money from the taxpayers. And the public, there were little stories about how they're swapping land and how they had to do this because of height restrictions. Nobody realizes they paid $1 for property in their, which is now worth, I think, about $15 million. They trade it for another piece of property worth $26 million. That's the way it goes. If public officials were to study the issue on its own without the omnipresent lawyers and lobbyists sticking their fingers into it, I think they'd make different decisions. But they don't. So before I get into what we do about it, what drives it, and so on, first I'd like to give the rationale for what I've heard in past 11, 12 years in the legislature on why we as a government, either a state or local governments, need to subsidize private businesses. The first of which, and it's a common one, I think every community in the country has done this, or talked about at least, that is to lure jobs. I mean, sometimes they may cut very good deals. You give a modest subsidy of some tax breaks and you create hundreds of new jobs. Other times, I think it was Alabama or Georgia a number of years ago, tried to lure a Mercedes-Benz plant, and they said it was several million dollars per job created that they ended up subsidizing. And so you might have good deals and bad deals, but basically the concept is bidding between communities. If we don't put in a subsidy here, they're gonna move over there, and they figure over there, if we don't put in a bigger subsidy, they'll go over there. And so the businesses have learned, you fight various governments, you tell them we're gonna create jobs in doing this. There are several economists who have argued this is a terrible way to stimulate the economy to create jobs, because there's no net gain of jobs to the economy, it's just where they're placed. In businesses, we've learned you can bid between communities. Sports teams are doing this particular item. And two economists at the Federal Reserve Bank have been speaking out saying, you know, it's good to have competition between communities, but the way government should be competing to please businesses would be, perhaps, if you figure the things that government provides that are positive, it's safe communities, good infrastructure, well-educated, healthy workforce. That may be the most single valuable thing they have. The downside is to get these things, you have to pay for them. You have to pay taxes. So these Federal Reserve Board economists are saying, well, the way you should compete then is see who can provide those best services at the least cost. Some southern states decide we're going to go real cheap. We're not going to collect much in taxes, but our education system isn't going to be that good. And so businesses are going to choose. Some businesses want the high-tech, better jobs. Some want the lower taxes. But they said that's a reasonable type of competition. But the corporate subsidy where, okay, if you move here, we'll give you this special tax break, but not your competitor business, not somebody else, then everybody else ends up paying for those subsidy. And they've argued it's very unhealthy for the economy. And basically, you just have a costly bidding war between communities. I'd argue that's a bad, inappropriate type of way to deal with things. States could clearly stop local governments from doing this. Why Minnesota benefits right now, one of the things on one of our stadium fights now is between St. Paul and Minneapolis. Stadium in Minneapolis, St. Paul, we're going to get one now too, and we're going to offer this big package. States could stop that. In the bidding war between states, you can unilaterally withdraw from it, which at times I think you should do. Or the other thing it could do is have the federal government could take care of it in a snap. But again, it's difficult to get that to happen. The second type of subsidies might be one that I would argue could be legitimate. I don't say corporate subsidies are never appropriate, but I think they're heavily overused. But there are times. What happens if you have an old site that has some contaminated land, polluted land? It's a land that you want the pollution cleaned up. And you want to have somebody develop a business there. And no business is going to want to buy land to put in a business that may produce, say, a couple million dollars a year if they could have a liability to clean up a piece of property to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. Those kind of subsidies, it seems to me, or for putting in some low subsidized housing, low rent housing types of things, you might decide you're going to have a public purpose to do that. And if you do a good deal of it, if you cut the deal right, it might be, I think, a reasonable thing to do. Why you can't just clean up the land yourself and then sell it to them for the what the market value of the land would be seems to be a better way, but one way or another, you're giving a, quote, subsidy to accomplish a public good. And I'd suggest that should be used cautiously, but could be used. The third argument I've seen used many times is that subsidies are good for community development. The term that they often use is you want to bring land to its highest and best use. If you have an old vacant lot, it doesn't bring in a lot of tax revenue because the value of the land isn't much. You put in a nice high-rise office building or a manufacturing plant, you're going to bring a lot more property taxes in because the land's more valuable. So aside from the creation of jobs, you're going to bring in more revenue. It's a great thing to do. Minneapolis, this uses a tool in Minnesota and many other states we call tax increment financing. If you have a vacant lot, it may bring in big property, downtown area, vacant lot might bring in $500,000 a year in property tax. You put a big office building on it, might bring in $3 million in property taxes. And so the incremental difference between the $500,000 you're bringing in now and the $3 million you would be bringing in, that difference of $2.5 million, people say, oh, that's, but for this development, we wouldn't have that money. So that's free money. So tax increment financing in Minnesota and a number of states is used, and it's often described as free money. It wouldn't be there if we didn't develop it, so let's use it. And that doesn't quite hold up to economic analysis, and the economists who aren't part of the development companies or the city staff usually say, you know, it doesn't quite work that way. In Minneapolis, I think I referred to it with this woman who had moved from working for the city, cutting a deal, then working for the developer now who she cut the deal with. They were going to put on our Nicollet Mall, our sort of pedestrian mall in downtown Minneapolis. They're going to redevelop the south end of this, and two developers, the two largest developers in the Twin Cities, were competing for the right to do it. And one of them said, we'll put in a Target store. Well, why do you want a Target store? Target store is a mid-range retailer, and one of the city council members said, you know, people who live downtown need a place to buy toilet paper and other necessities. So the one developer would put that in, but they wanted this subsidy that may be $30 or $40 million, I'll say conservatively $20 to $30 million, and so they cut the subsidy with them. But in doing so, tax increment financing is how they paid for it. They can say, well, the tax revenue we're getting out of this development that's been there for 20, 30, 40 years isn't bringing in as much money as these new office buildings and the new Target store, so that new money we'll spend for it. But is the incremental difference between the one developer that wants the money and the one that wouldn't do it $20 or $30 million? No. There may be no incremental difference there. And on top of that, 20 years down the line, by the time you stop paying into this tax increment account, by that time the development's kind of shabby and it's not the highest and best use, and somebody else wants to redevelop it. And so it's it gets back to the old thing I said at the beginning. These deals work on the nature of the complexity of them. They're very hard to explain. Tax increment financing in Minnesota, where it's used very heavily, just blows over most people's heads. They, well, I don't know, they said it's free money, it wouldn't be there otherwise, okay. But it's not that way. And corporate subsidies are very costly. They're usually hard to understand. They're usually inappropriate and excessive. And taxpayers do understand, they may not understand why they don't like a specific deal, but they do understand a lot of their money is going to subsidies that people who may not really need their money. What drives the passage of these corporate subsidies? Well, it's not public opinion. I don't really hear a lot of times the public is saying, we really need to subsidize business X, Y, or Z. Usually public opinion is strongly against it. It's not a neutral assessment of their values. I tried to get a bill that would ban our tax increment financing law and say, you know, the cities can still give the same amount of subsidy to the same developers for the same purposes under our existing law, only they couldn't do it with tax increment financing. So when the city of St. Paul gives a $50 to $100 million subsidy to Lawson Software Company to move from Minneapolis to St. Paul, but the mayor and city council say, yes, we want to give this subsidy to them, And we're going to give it to them. If they do it over 20 years, they can give it the same 20-year period of time, any way they want. But just say, look, we're going to take it out of your property taxes. We're going to do it here. But don't worry, folks. We're going to get more than that much money back. You're going to get the money back and more. It's a great deal. But if a mayor and city council can sell that to the public, let them do it. I just don't think they can sell it to the public because I don't think it's legit. But it's not a neutral assessment of their value. And it is heavy lobbying from those who seek the subsidies. It tends to be the cozy relationships, which is why the firm has great desire to hire the city staff who cuts the deal. It tends to be campaign contributions and gifts from the bond houses that underwrite the deals. Subsidy seekers tend to be big players in the community. I'm not a Washington resident, but I know Paul Allen is a big figure in the community. Now he's being called to step in and maybe help with the Seattle Seahawks, with the Mariners now. He's got the Seahawks, other way around. In Minnesota, one of my former colleagues owns the Minnesota Timberwolves basketball team. And they're talking about trying to get him and some others to get in to buy the baseball team because the Twins owner is very unpopular because he's been pushing for a subsidy for a long time. And he's a billionaire. This other billionaire is not as well known and not as well disliked. Yeah, you may change it. But they have great access. And the stadiums are a perfect example of how they have access. I remember I gave a talk last week on money in politics. And in that I talked about how the Twins owner, they've been trying to get subsidies out of the state for several years now. And the Twins owner and the 20 or 30 lobbyists they hired back in 96 for their big push in 97, I tried to document how much money they gave in campaign contributions to lawmakers, the governor, to the legislative caucuses, our Democratic Party Senate caucus and the Republican Senate caucus. They give money, large contributions to them instead of just individual candidates. And I had tallied up a whole bunch of these that had been done by September of 96, the primary of our last general election, our general election in 96. And I had a news conference talk with reporters. They thought it was, they were glad somebody was creating a controversy over the stadium because it was very quiet. They were trying to keep it quiet before the election. But they thought it was dumb that I was making a big stink of the money stuff because they said, look, these aren't that big of contributions. That happens all the time. And the only person who took any note was a sports reporter for the Minneapolis paper who didn't cover the Capitol. The Capitol press corps is used to this stuff. They're kind of jaded and cynical about it all. The sports reporter thought this was a big thing. So he wrote front page, not of the sports section, but of our Metro section, wrote a big story. Polad, the owner of the Twins, Polad spreads his wealth around. And it talked about how he gave large contributions, he and his sons gave large contributions to the Democratic Party caucuses and the Republican Party caucuses. Now, I know a lot of you may be independent voters, and you may decide, I like this guy who's running for president, and this woman who's running for Senate, and this guy who's running for that. And you give money to people regardless of their party. Because you're an independent, you like some of each party. I doubt anybody in this room, unless you're a lobbyist or unless you're trying to get something, gives money to both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. I mean, what's the rationale for it? Anyhow, the sports reporter asked the Twins lobbyists, well, why are they giving contributions now? The Polad family is very wealthy, but they haven't made a lot of campaign contributions in the past. His response was simple. But they've never had an issue this big before the legislature before. Well, tell me why they made it. They made it because they wanted to gain access. Well, why are they giving money to both parties? When a Polad's son said, well, it's not a partisan issue. It's a bipartisan sort of thing. I said, that meant they're trying to buy both parties.
That's the win-win.
Good point. Anyhow, I think that the difficulty I've seen is people love sports. You know, when I saw an article about my dad when I was a little kid, I was quoted, they interviewed each kid in the family, what they wanted to be. I was a fourth grader. My number one goal in life was to be a hockey player. My number two goal was to be a football player. And how many fourth and fifth grade kids want that? I mean, that's, they love sports. I love sports, but, you know, there's the difference between who should be funding it and whether sports is out of control or not. But aside from that, people love sports. And so when we talk about a subsidy for Northwest Airlines, which Minnesota did, I don't think it was a good move. It gave them enough money for one guy to run for California governor a few years later, who said he was going to buy his way into office. And I think he spent $30 million and lost. But he was going to spend over $30 million he lost in the primary. In any case, sports subsidies are different than other ones because people identify with their team. I mean, how do you define Minnesota, University of Minnesota? It's the Golden Gophers. Minnesota, that's Vikings land or Twins land. It's not, hey, this is 3M country. And yeah, 3M creates a lot more jobs in Minnesota than those businesses. But there's an understandable civic pride. You know, the Twins won the World Series twice in the last decade and a half. And hey, I and most of the community were loudly cheering. And we keep cheering for the Vikings too, and someday they might actually win. They come close. This year might be a good one, which makes it difficult for those of us who are opposing the subsidies. But the owners know that, and they take advantage of it, and they try and do it through a number of things. I'm going to just quickly go down a number of things, and then I like to leave 20, 30 minutes, if I can, for discussion. So I'll quickly go through some of the things they've done. First of all, it's all based on the dysfunctional economics of Major League Sports. Players demand more money, owners want more money. It's not a market economy. If you want to form a professional baseball team and hire the best players you can get, you can't do it. You can, but you got to form your own league, which is not realistically the way you do it. Now, if you decide that you want to manufacture tape and compete with 3M or airline engines to provide to Boeing, and you want to compete with Pratt and Whitney or whoever else sells them airline engines, you can do that, and you get your little niche, and you probably don't have to, you don't have to start a whole new airplane manufacturing company. You form a little part manufacturing plant to make a little better part of better widgets for whatever better part of the product you want to do, and you can compete. And there's no limit on it. But if you want to start a baseball team, you got to form your own league, or you got to pay some, you got to get the owners to agree to it. So it's not a free market, it's an oligopoly, and they realize that. But the owners keep, the owners and the athletes, it's not one villain in this thing, they're not bad people. So when Minnesota Timberwolves, the basketball team, got a subsidy from the taxpayers about 6 years ago now, that was, they built the stadium, the arena privately, and then they came to us and asked them to bail it out, or the team was going to move. They got new owners and they got the whole deal, and this was going to take care of it for 30 years. Well, in 1997, about 3.5 years later, when we were talking about the Twins stadium, Timberwolves owners come in and say, listen, you know, the economics of professional basketball have changed. Minnesota that year had offered the highest ever contract, one-time contract for a professional athlete, $126 million for a 21-year-old kid for a seven-year contract. It still is the highest as far as I know, though they're going to surpass it soon for shorter contracts. But he's a good ball player. He's very good. But $126 million, somebody calculated every second on the floor how many thousands of bucks the thing is. It's a lot of money. And, you know, if it's a market economy, if people want to pay that much to go to basketball games, and the owners want to pay that much to the athletes, and they want to pay that, that's all fine. But basically, as the salaries go up, the owners demand more, and the easy way to get it is to get it from the taxpayers. And the taxpayers basically keep subsidizing it, and I like to compare it to alcoholism. It's a serious problem. And if you're a family member of an alcoholic and the person needs money and you give them money, meaning well, you're basically enabling them to continue their addiction. And we've got a dysfunctional economic system and we keep doing it. In Minnesota now, they're saying, you know, Minnesota, they can't compete in Minnesota. We're only the 14th now, 15th largest media market in the country. we're a small market. Well, there are a lot of communities with teams smaller than the 15th largest, but nevertheless, we're a small market. We can't compete with the Yankees. They have a payroll much higher than our team. We can't compete with them. So we're going to buy them a new stadium. Well, the Yankees are talking how they need a $500 million stadium too at public expense. It's basically a dysfunctional economy. They take advantage of the public. Voters have rejected them in many cases. Seattle, at least the Mariners one that voters rejected, yeah. And they found a way, I don't remember whether you rejected a sales tax or a lottery thing, and they came back with a different type of funding for it. In Milwaukee, the voters rejected a lottery funding thing, and they came back, the legislature came back and put in a sales tax. And so they will find a way around it. Minneapolis, the voters passed a referendum. There's no provision for something like this, so it was not a stadium proposal before them. But at the same time, the state was debating subsidizing the Twins. Voters started an initiative in Minneapolis saying the city cannot spend more than $10 million on a professional sports subsidy without explicit voter approval. Before that one even passed, and it passed by a landslide, before it even passed, voters were all, the city council was already talking about how they could get around it. And they haven't yet, and so on, but they try and get around the voters. When they do go to the public, Paul Allen in 1997 in Seattle, he gave new meaning to the term buying an election. He persuaded the legislature to put it on the ballot as long as he'd pay for the election. So the $4 million or whatever the election cost, he put that money out to pay for the election judges, the printing of the ballots, everything. I mean, it was a privately financed election. Then, of course, he refused to debate. I'm saying this as an outside observer, so if I'm wrong on this, feel free to correct me. But that he refused to debate during the course of it, instead outspent his opponents. I think I calculated it, the Seattle paper hadn't, but I think I calculated 27-1. He outspent his opponents, and he narrowly squeaked by. He got his subsidy. But they go around that. They try all kinds of other tricks. The owner of the Twins was, they've got this competing thing. Is he really generous or is he really stingy? They're not sure which image to sell, so they've been trying to say, look, he's losing money. They won't show us all their books, but he's losing money, so we got to subsidize it. He's losing $10 million a year. So we've got to subsidize it because he's a businessman and he won't take it. Then they turn around and say, well, he's such a generous guy, he's going to donate the team to charity. Donate the team and take the tax write-off. And of course, there was another thing that struck me as a different meaning of the word donate. He was asking for the state or the charity to pay for the cost of the team that he was donating to them. I was donating like it was free. But they try, it's all the kind of a little bit of confusion. One time he was going to donate 49% of the team to the public. And then he was going to say, but they could never, the other 51% could never be combined with that 49%, which basically meant if he ever wanted to sell a team for $120 million, he was going to sell it for $120 million for the 51% share. They said that was half the team he was giving to the public. I said, why don't we switch the halves around? But they didn't like that idea. One or two more points, and then I'll give my solutions and open it. The Vikings were bought by a new owner last year. A Texas billionaire who paid $206 million for it. The previous owners did very well for it. They borrowed money to pay for it out of the seat sales, the licenses when the team was originally founded. And so they turned out very well. They put not really any of their own money in. They got $206 million for it. Now the new guy who bought it, he's a very shrewd businessman and so on. The team's been doing very well. I think they should have made it or won the Super Bowl. They blew it in a playoff game, but the day they were in the playoff game that they lost, there was an article in the paper assessing the value of the team. They said the team had gone up in value. They talked to several sports economists. The team's value had gone up by somewhere between $25 and $150 million. Not because the team was playing better, but because that's what the market of NFL teams had been with the new football TV contract, what the Redskins had sold for, and so on. So his team value went up in about 8 or 9 months by at least $25 million. He's got a 12-year or 11-year binding contract to keep playing in the Metrodome. And the Minneapolis city officials are talking about renovating the Metrodome to make it more pleasing to them at a cost of $200 million. This thing was built for $80 million 15 years ago. Going to spend $200 million to renovate it. And he says that's not good enough. He wants more. He wants a new stadium at $300-some million. You know, how much do we need to give him? He's already making money faster than most people could ever dream of it. And on the team even, but we still have to subsidize it. And then, like in Washington State here, I think the Mariners Stadium, I think the team contribution was to donate Safeco or whoever naming rights. They get, you know, sell the names of a stadium. You make money from that. I think it was 40-some million. I think their contribution was 40-some million. And that's part of the new plan, the St. Paul plan. City will pay one-third, state will pay one-third, the team will put it one-third. They get to keep all the naming rights, all the concession revenue, all the other stuff. And if you want to understand what a scam that is, switch it around. Why don't they pay for the stadium and we'll donate the naming rights? We'll donate the concession revenue, or at least some of it, and we'll donate the suite rental. That doesn't work. I mean, who, you might ask, why do we, the public, have the right to name their stadium? Well, it's a sham. I mean, if we're building it, their right to name our stadium and make money off it and then donate that, it's not really a donation. It's really public money. But that's the way they try all these things. The new Viking Twin Stadium, they said was going to, Minneapolis papers love these things. They sell half the papers based on the sports section. They had a thing, it's only costing Minnesota taxpayers 3 cents per week for 30 years, and that's longer than the stadium will last. So I wrote a response to it saying that, you know, in St. Paul, it's going to cost the average family of four $3,780 a week, which they had called a relatively small chunk of change, 3 cents a week. And I suggested that maybe some St. Paul families may beg to differ with their characterization of it. They'll try saying, oh, it's not real taxpayer money, we'll use gambling money, we'll use but-for money. If the team wasn't here, we wouldn't have this money. Again, I said earlier, the economists don't accept that as a neutral, as a true source of money. So what are the solutions? I went longer than I wanted here. Cut through the complexity of it, abolish tax increment financing types of schemes. I offered a plan to have the Twins build their own stadium paid for with the revenues from the new stadium. They actually bring in more than enough money to pay for themselves, so either the teams want us to, they want a subsidy. I said, well, if they don't make quite enough new money when they build the stadium that pays for itself, we could talk about writing out a check to the owner of the team every year, and we could debate at the Capitol how much it should be for. But again, they don't want that because it won't pass. And then, I'd suggest we got to educate the public of what's going on. St. Paul's new hockey arena that's being built, it's a public facility, they said. We're going to put the money in because it's a public facility. But St. Paul, which owns it, they have to pay rent to the hockey team if they want to use it more than 10 days a year. Not just the cost of operating, but they got to pay an actual out-of-pocket rent as well if they want to use their public facility. The other two things I'd say is block campaign contributions and gifts from special interests. They don't have the access. Sports teams are going to have more than others just because a lot of politicians, like I said, I wanted to be an athlete when I grew up, but you wouldn't believe how many politicians, I think our former governor would have loved to sit on the bench with the Gophers. That would be his number one job, be an assistant coach. And I know a lot of my colleagues, if they could sit on the Vikings bench or be in the dugout of the Twins games, that's their lifetime goal. I mean, that would be their dream come true. And so they'll have some access, but block the campaign contributions, block the gifts to public officials. And the final step would have to stop the bidding war by the federal government stepping in and saying, you're not going to be allowed to do this anymore. And there are several proposals that would do that, but the leagues have a lot of lobbying clout, and that's not likely to happen soon. I went on about 10 minutes longer than I wanted, but this is the kind of topic with lots of meat and a lot of people with interest in it. And go ahead with either challenging things or questioning things or going further on things.
Well, one thing I think was especially true in Seattle is the newspaper. It's the two major ones, or the one major one, actually. Put a lot of time into essentially deceiving the public on it because they have a strong interest in sports. You said 50%, I think that's about right, because I used to see more guys at work who would buy the paper, pull out the sports section, and throw the rest away.
And it's even worse with the broadcast media, especially the ones that WCCO Radio in the Twin Cities is one of the clear channel stations, one of the largest stations in the upper Midwest. And they broadcast Twins games, Vikings games. They love it. It's good for them. Half their stuff is sports talk every night. 3-4 hours prime time listening is sports talk. They want a stadium there. They want to make sure there's, even if the team won't move, you know, they have some of their access to the interviews with the coaches and the players. You know, if you're not in favor of what the team wants, you're not as likely to get that. But you're right. There's a media has a vested interest in this, and they don't report it neutrally, which is a real frustration for those who are on the opposite side of the media on it.
And they define quality of life in the Twin Cities as having a major sports team.
Yeah. Yes. For people, if anyone here is from Omaha, they keep always talking about how if we don't have professional sports, Minnesota will be a cold Omaha. And I don't want to insult Omaha, but I think the Twin Cities are a pretty nice place, and I traveled to Omaha in recent years, and it may be a very nice place too, but you know, I think we've got a lot more to what's going on than that, and I don't mind subsidizing high school teams, and we do. Public high schools are taxpayer-supported. The coach of the Minneapolis North boys basketball team, which has been state champion 2 years in a row, it's a largely African-American community, very poor kids, and excellent basketball players, and they've won 2 state championships in a row. The coach there said his biggest frustration was they can't even have a junior varsity team because they don't have enough money for coaches. He says all these kids come in there with their basketball dreams, their hoop dreams, and they get turned away because we don't have enough coaches to handle them. Kids who could be good and so on. And we don't put the few $1,000 a year it would cost to provide them a coach, but tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars we're willing to do it. You're right, it's quality of life is what they say.
Tax money in Seattle is another big issue because whenever it comes to schools or healthcare or even highways, the first big concern is where can we possibly get the money from? When it came to the stadium, it says, oh, we have this big pot of gold, there's no problem.
I was going to say, in Minnesota, the issue is, well, we'll just use gambling money because it's not really tax money. And my argument is, let's look at the issue separately. If you think that you should get more money from gambling and put in a state casino, which is one of the proposals, put in a state casino or racetrack, allow them to have off-track betting and all these other things. If you think that that's a legitimate public policy thing to do and it brings in money, then do it. Make the decision, do it, you get more money, and then decide would you rather spend that for a stadium or for schools or for whatever else, or for tax cuts of other types of taxes. But they try and, it's always, you gotta tie it to something else. But it really is, once it's collected, it's public money, and then public should decide where they want to spend it. And very definitely some people want to spend it on the sports subsidies, but I don't think you win by doing that. I think in the end you just feed the higher salaries, which we all complain about.
In Cleveland, they wanted to use tobacco money, which hadn't been brought up yet. There was a big debate about the sin tax.
Yeah.